If you were in downtown Mason yesterday, you may be forgiven for thinking it was the mid-1960s or you were having some kind of flashback. There was a large group of vintage cars there yesterday for the filming of a movie. And this was about, I am told, this was about the trials that followed the Detroit riots back in the mid-1960s. And I'm sorry, but I'm not clear on who's responsible for this movie production. But what happened historically here is that the trials that ensued after some of the killings in the Detroit riots, the trials took place in Mason. I presume it was a situation in which prosecutors or the courts did not feel they could get a fair trial in Detroit, perhaps. So they moved to Mason. I was living in mid-Michigan then, but the fact that those trials took place in Mason has been lost to me over these many years. But that's what that was all about. If you happen to witness the, I want to say a good dozen, maybe 20 vintage cars in downtown Mason near the county courthouse yesterday. I'm Mark Bayshore. This is Current State. At the top of our program, the city of Flint continues to make progress to restore drinking water to its residents. The city's in the midst of a huge effort, of course, to replace thousands of lead service lines that supply water to businesses and residents. It's a big job that requires a lot of time and money and coordination. A state panel oversees this work in Flint. Our first guest is an East Lansing resident who serves on the Flint Water Interagency Coordinating Committee. Michael McDaniel's a retired Army Brigadier General who once served as Homeland Security Advisor to former Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm. He's also known for leading the community investigation into the Board of Water and Light following our historic winter storm in 2013. He's a professor of law at WMU Cooley Law School. And today, General McDaniel coordinates the Fast Start program that is the lead service line replacement effort in Flint. He joins me now, and we welcome you back.
Thank you, Mark.
We're eager to be updated on the lead pipe replacement effort, but first let's learn a little bit more about the Flint Water Interagency Coordinating Committee, sometimes referred to as FWIC. What is the mission there?
That committee was set up by Governor Snyder some months ago, back at the beginning of the year, and the idea was to have a meeting place, a venue in which we would have information sharing from all the state agencies that are involved, from the city, from the county of Genesee, from representatives from the hospital, representatives from some of the non-governmental organizations that are involved, such as Red Cross, representatives from, it seems to me, Michigan State University Cooperative Extension is there. Dr. Mona Hanna Atisha, affiliated with Michigan State, is on the panel, and sort of have on a weekly basis, now on a biweekly basis, have this opportunity to sort of deconflict rumors that might be out there and to have a better coordination of the efforts. What it has done over time has sort of dissipated distrust and sort of built trust among the many different government agencies and others that are involved.
What's it like to work with all of the members on that? How many separate agencies or interests are represented on FWIC?
I'm going to guess there's at least 18 to 20 different entities that are directly involved, and others come and sit in the audience as well. What ends up happening? It creates its own process when you've got an active commission like this. So everyone has their own assignments. Everyone knows what they are doing. And then every Friday, every other Friday, you have an opportunity before and after the meeting to sort of grab somebody, buttonhole somebody, and say, "Hey, I need this," or "We need to work together on this." What staff do you have that should be working on this issue? So it's been very, very productive and helpful in that regard.
I want to get to the lead pipe replacement, but I've got to ask you one more question involving FLIC. The dynamics, the leadership dynamics, I guess, that are involved in a committee like this are always interesting. Is there, in effect, a lead agency that is more influential in making FWIC work than somebody else?
Well, it's sort of chaired out of the governor's office. The governor chairs every meeting. On a couple of occasions, it's been the lieutenant governor. And immediately sitting to, whether it's governor or lieutenant governor, to their left is the mayor of the city of Flint.
Okay.
So it's an opportunity to have this sort of joint leadership, but it's hosted, presented by the governor's office. And it's worked very well as a result.
And the Flint water team, I take it, out of Virginia Tech, has a seat at the table.
Yeah, Dr. Mark Edwards is on. Usually he's on by conference call, but he's been there in person as well.
You coordinate the Fast Start program in Flint. That's the ongoing effort to replace these lead service lines that supply water to hundreds of homes. It was reported this week that so far lines have been replaced at about 160 homes. Just describe the effort right now for us. How is it going?
It's going very well. It was, and that's gratifying, Mark, because, man, it was a slow start. So it's great to be doing this. As of last night, we're at 174 lines for this phase. We had done about 39 lines total back in April, May of this year. And that was part of either efforts that the city did with the EPA or that the city did with the Department of Environmental Quality as sort of a pilot study.
Well, are crews replacing lines at a faster rate then? Does that represent hitting the gas?
Yes. Yes. And that's because of a couple of things. First, we're now just going right down the street. We identify the areas that need their lines replaced the most based upon the density of lead or lead to galvanized service lines, population over 65 in a neighborhood, children under 6, and if there has been substantially high lead in water as a result of water sampling within that neighborhood as well. Doesn't have to be at that house, but it has to be in that neighborhood. And based upon that criteria, we've fed the data in using a couple of computer science professors from U of M Ann Arbor, fed that data in, and we've sort of pick the neighborhoods that have the highest rankings of all of those.
And then you go just right down the street.
It was more of a
slapdash approach at the beginning.
Yeah, right. You know, we would react to where there was a high water sampling, and now we're going right down the street based upon those criteria. And that's made a huge difference.
You must think in terms of how you can accelerate that even more. Is there room to improve the rate at which you replace these, and how do you do that?
Yeah, I had I wasn't in the contract, but I verbally told the three different contractors that we had out for this last September phase that we're just ending. I told them they had to do that we had to do in total between the three different firms 10 to 15 lines a day. So for this next phase, which we're going to do in the month of October, we have told them that there's going to be three contracts, and on each contract you have to do at least 100 lines in 35 days or pay liquidated damages to the city. Mm. So we're sort of putting the screws to them. As a result of that, we had fewer bidders, and we have accepted contracts. It hasn't been approved by city council yet, but from ones that we have used before and sort of know the process, have learned it sort of on the job and know what has to be done.
Some dropped out, though? Is that
what
you're saying?
Oh, yeah. We lost a number of bidders as a result of that. We had, I think, maybe 6 final bidders only, and 3 to 4 of those were too high.
We're talking with Brigadier General Michael McDaniel, who is in charge of the Fast Start program in Flint. That's the ongoing effort to replace lead service lines that supply water to hundreds of homes. Your team certainly had a lot of contact with homeowners. Then, obviously, what is the mood these days? What are you hearing from these homeowners?
That's a great question, Mark, because the mood has changed. It's evolved. When we would first go out there, you know, you have to knock on the door, you have to tell them what we're doing, you have to get permission both from the homeowner, the property owner, and the resident if they are distinct separate individuals or entities. And so that was a longer process than it should have been. And we're working, hopefully, to expedite that process as well. But between that initial resistance and now when we're out there on their street, they see us sort of working down the street on a daily basis, they're very receptive to our efforts.
And generally cooperative?
Very cooperative. I think we've had maybe out of the almost 200 we've done, 175 that we have done thus far in this phase. I think that we had 3 that were somewhat aggressively non-compliant or non-interested.
Mm. This has obviously been a huge task for everybody involved, not just Flint City government, but state agencies, the EPA, and on and on. It's not been all that long since Flint was under an emergency manager, and City Hall operated for some time under a skeleton staff to save money. Have you moved beyond that phase when you were really reduced in resources, human resources? How does that look now?
When I first started volunteering there in February, I think the mayor had an administrative assistant. She had just hired a PR person, and I think she had a part-time receptionist. So since then, she's
That was it, in the mayor's office.
So she's since hired a new city administrator. The previous one had been hired by the emergency manager. She's hired a chief of staff. She's hired a city engineer. She's hired staff in the water treatment plant, actively looking for more staff in the water treatment plant. We need to hire a couple more plumbing inspectors to assist with the efforts that we're doing on a part-time basis. We still need to hire a director of public works, but she has built the staff. And that is one of the reasons, Mark, why it took so long to get this RFP. You know, from May until September, basically, we were trying to get out an RFP and get started again. And it was a time of frustration for me. But it was a matter of hiring new staff, new officials into city government, and messing with the existing staff, sort of learning what the process was there, bucking the institutional history perhaps to some degree, and sort of creating a brand new process for doing the acceptance of these RFPs and doing something that was new, you know, in terms of you have to have city staff assisting us when we're out there. You know, the plumbing inspector, the right-of-way inspector, the restoration of the streets, all has to be done by, at least in this phase, done by the city officials and employees, and they weren't there before. So it's a matter of having to learn a whole new process, and we've finally got to that point.
I want to get to the federal funding that has been earmarked for Flint, because I'm certain that will play some kind of role in your efforts. But explain how your work has been funded thus far. Just clarify that landscape for us.
Sure. Early on, the state, the governor's office, freed up $2 million that was a reimbursement to the city. It was called a reimbursement to the city for money that the city had spent on buying water from the Great Lakes Water Authority. And that's what we've used for this September phase for these 200 that we hope homes to have done by the end of this week. There was then a $25 million sort of legislative grant specifically for service line replacements. And we've been implementing that, and we are ready to start. As soon as we have city council and RTAB approval, we're ready to start using that $25 million. Interestingly, with that money, the legislature put a couple of conditions on that. You can't spend more than $5 million per service line replacement, and you can't spend any money on permit fees to the city. So the city has some adjustment to do to find the staff, as I said before, to assist and support the efforts of the contractors out there, and the contractors' bids had to come in at $5,000 or less, which is pretty tight because we have some really unique situations up there with a lot of older homes, years of neglect in terms of the city system and then the homes as well. So it's not as clean as we would have hoped, where you've just got 50 feet of service line between the street and the home itself. You know, we've got this situation where these lines snake around behind the house and through a neighbor's yard. We have them going to other streets. Sometimes it's difficult to even find the service line.
Well, how much does the funding picture concern you? Is your effort sustainable over the long haul?
Well, at the $27 million, that's not enough to do the entire city in terms of, and when I say entire city, I mean all of the lead and lead to galvanized lines that we found in the city. One of the things I learned as we went on, that worse than lead service lines is when you have a lead line on the city side from the main to the curb, and then from the curb to the home, you have a galvanized
right.
line because the galvanized corrodes, it'll adhere more lead. That's a very common situation. Mm. According to city records, we thought we had about 6,000 lines. As it turns out, 96% of the lines we found so far have been partially lead or all lead. So I don't think that will extrapolate across the city because
that's higher than you would have expected.
Much higher.
Okay.
But I do think it'll be closer to 15,000 lines that we'll have to replace.
The House approved the $170 million earmark for plumbing replacement there. The Senate passed its own bill earlier, and now that legislation will go to a joint conference committee. Are you privy to any of those discussions on Capitol Hill? Do you know any more about that funding?
Everything I've heard on that has been secondhand, of course, but I know that folks from the city and the state are watching that very closely. The thought is that money can definitely be used for service line replacement. Sort of our goal here, Mark, is to do this more holistically. I mean, one of the criticisms could be that we're just replacing the service line, and we don't know if that's the only source of potential lead contamination. So what we want to do is we want to be able to, starting in 2017, go into the home, and we replace the service line, we replace the water meter, and then we do a lead assessment throughout the house. We look at the pipes that we see in the basement. We check the fixtures and the faucets. We look at the type of solder that we have there. We want to sample paint, and we want to sample soils so that we can say to the homeowner that we have addressed all potential sources of lead contamination in that home or yard. We're not doing that yet, but to me, that's what we have to do to not only address this holistically, but be able to assure the public that we've truly addressed the problem of lead contamination. Mayor Weaver says we got to get the lead out of Flint. Well, you know, to do that, we have to do more than just service lines.
We have been talking about the ongoing effort to replace the lead service lines that feed hundreds of homes in the city of Flint. Those pipes have leached lead particles into the drinking water over time. Retired Brigadier General Mike McDaniel coordinates Flint's Fast Start program. He's a faculty member on the WMU Cooley Law School College of Law as well, and he serves as a volunteer on the Flint Water Interagency Coordinating Committee. General McDaniel, thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Its current state on 90.5 WKAR. The Art Prize competition in Grand Rapids bills itself as the most attended public art event on the planet. Upwards of 400,000 people are expected to have taken in this year's Art Prize. By the time it ends on Sunday, there will be a pair of $200,000 grand prizes, one juried by art experts and another based on a vote of attendees. Entries were down a little bit this year, but their works have been displayed at more venues. Two Michigan artists working together under the name Shiny Seed are in the finals for the public vote in the three-dimensional category. They are Gene Folk and Casey Dixon. Welcome, Gene.
Hi.
And Casey, welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Shiny Seed's entry is called Invasive Species. It's on display at the PNC Bank building on Monroe Avenue Northwest. Welcome to Current State, and congratulations on being a finalist. Let's start with how you know each other, how it's come to be that you work together, and what is Shiny Seed?
Well, we know each other through a makerspace in Ann Arbor called MakerWorks. I've been a member there for a number of years, and Casey's a manager there.
And tell us a little bit more about what happens at the Makerspace.
So MakerWorks is, like, number one, the best makerspace in the world. and then it's also like a gym. So you buy membership, you gain access to tools. So we have a full metal shop, wood shop, craft, circuits area. With a little bit of training, usually our safety classes, you can come in and use those tools with membership.
And describe invasive species for our listeners. What will they see?
They're going to see a very large metal tree sculpture. It is wrapped in aluminum wire, about 18 feet high, similarly wide. And we have 24 LED orbs, we call them fruit of the tree, that hang from it. And the LEDs go through a variety of different patterns and colors.
And how did the idea for this evolve, Casey?
Gene approached me after a Christmas party with
it came from you then?
Yep. Yes. He makes these cool little metal trees, and we were talking about how cool it would be to stand underneath one, and what would it be like to make it bigger. And so we started doing sketches. It kept growing and getting bigger and more awesome. And eventually, you know, now it's standing on the corner of Pearl and Monroe.
You work in metal a lot, Gene?
Not really. I mean, I've always done just various art things on the side, just for fun. And these little metal trees was just one of them. It was wire, like twisted wire. I've done a few pieces like that. And I've had this idea of doing a much bigger one floating around my head for a few years, but never had quite the impetus to try it.
Some of the most impressive pieces that have really resonated with me in recent years have been metallic sculptures. I'm thinking of the piece by the Broad Art Museum. in East Lansing. There's also a piece at the Meyer Garden in Grand Rapids. I want to say it's of a brain cell. It's called Synapse or something like that. It can be is metal work more fashionable right now? Is it more in favor or what?
I think it's always been fashionable. It might be more in the public eye, but for us, the scale that we wanted to do, and like, you know, it's going to be out with people. Metal seemed to be the obvious choice because it was okay and fast and strong to work with.
And why invasive species? Just thematically, why did you name this invasive species?
So
they're looking at each other. I was going to explain
this in a couple of minutes is so, a bit tough.
Yes, it is. The reason we call it invasive species is because this thing inspired us and we wanted to make something that would be inspiring, because we found that when someone gets inspired, they tend to do something about it. They're going to go out, they're going to draw something, tell a good story, buy something, whatever. They're impacting their environment. They're changing their reality. And hopefully someone else will see it and it'll continue throughout their environment. So in that sense, they're the invasive species. So what we're doing is we're introducing this thing into the environment, hoping to see it go out and propagate through our society, culture, environment, however you want to take it. Mm.
So it spreads through people is the idea.
How do people tend to, have you been there when people see it for the first time? How do people tend to respond to it? What do they say?
There's a variety, but you know, the best responses is someone just sort of gaping there, with just staring at it with their mouth agape. That's the best response.
You like that response?
Yes.
Casey Dixon and Gene Falk are of the Ann Arbor Maker Works, are finalists in the public vote at the Grand Rapids Art Prize. They'll find out in a few days if their entry, Invasive Species, under the collective name Shiny Seed, is a winner. Is this your first entry in Art Prize for both of you?
It is.
Okay.
It's our first time at Art Prize.
First time you visited.
Yeah.
Were you surprised to be accepted?
Not into Art Prize itself. It's a pretty democratic process. I mean, as long as you find a venue willing to host you, you're in. But it's very exciting to be selected by the public as one of the finalists.
What is it? What about you, Casey?
The whole experience has kind of been, you know, like Gene said, with the public, humbling, just because that many people enjoying what we do is...
That's got to be fantastic.
It's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. How did you become an artist?
I started drawing with crayons when I was like 3. I don't know. I've always had a compulsion to create and make stuff. And I'm semi-creative, so I think that's why the artist thing meshes together.
What medium do you work best in, would you say?
Oh.
If you could create one more piece in the rest of your life, what would it be? What would the medium be?
That's so tough, man. I'm working on like a kid's book right now, and I really want to finish that. So I feel like that might be the next one. But, you know, working with metal and wood and everything is...
What about you, Gene?
Yeah, I'd hate to be restricted to a particular medium. This mixed media, you know, we're here, we've got metal, we've got lights, we've got a sensor to be interactive. It's just being able to pull all these various things together, that's what makes it fun.
Are you both Michigan guys?
Born and raised.
Where?
I grew up in Ann Arbor.
Okay.
Jackson, Michigan.
Okay, Jackson, all right. Now, the grand prize in the public vote is $200,000. Is there a prize for the... for the three-dimensional category, if you don't go on to claim the grand prize?
There is a prize for the winner of each category. There's 4 categories.
Yeah. 5 finalists in each category, yes, from what I understand. By our count, 6 of the 20 overall finalists are from Michigan. Is there a home field advantage in the public vote, do you think?
I think there may be. There are certainly people who prefer the local artists. I mean, it's going to depend on the individuals.
We've talked enough about the work itself. Again, it's called Invasive Species. Remind our listeners where they will find it. They've heard enough about it. They got to go see it now.
It's on the corner of Pearl and Monroe, just right downtown, right across from Rosa Park Circle.
Right outside the PNC Bank
building. Monroe Avenue, Northwest Grand Rapids. Fantastic. What does the future hold for this particular piece? I mean, will it be on display elsewhere? Is it going to make the round somewhere else, or is it going to be for sale, or what?
It is for sale. We're hoping to find a buyer, and hopefully we find a home for it. Hopefully somewhere that the public can still see and enjoy it.
Mm-hmm. I've had a lot of people ask, and we're hoping that it's someplace like that everybody has access to it.
Oh, sure. You want as many eyes on this as you possibly can, I imagine. I understand it got damaged somehow. Is that true?
One evening, it was last Saturday or the Saturday before, the first Saturday of our prize, someone broke the door open, and that's basically what's guarding the brain of the tree.
There's a fairy door. It's for people who are wondering, why is there a door on this?
Yeah.
The brain of the tree does what? It controls the lights?
It controls the fruit, yeah.
Oh, the fruit.
And the sensor.
How many pieces of fruit are there on the tree?
It's 24.
Okay. Have you had a chance to look around the rest of the art prize?
A little bit. I've tried to, it's been busy, I've tried to get around and look around. I hope to, once this weekend, I'm hoping to really get around more.
Okay.
It's actually awesome and inspiring to see other people's work.
Yeah.
The amount of like attention to detail, level of craft and awesomeness has been inspiring.
Well, it's been great to talk to both of you. We want to wish you both luck. We've been talking with artists Casey Dixon and Gene Falk, known collectively as Shiny Seed, based at, now does Shiny Seed have another work in mind? I should ask that.
We've got one in mind. We'll see if it can come to fruition.
Okay. We've got the name down in our brain, so we will keep track of Shiny Seed. Shiny Seed's based at Maker Works in Ann Arbor. Their piece is called Invasive Species. It's an art prize public vote finalist with winners to be announced on Sunday. Congratulations, and good luck to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Coming up on Current State, is your spouse cranky or happy? An MSU professor says if your spouse is happy, you will be healthy. A new study says there's a direct correlation. Current State's Brooke Allen follows up on the research with MSU assistant professor Bill Chopik. That's coming up later this hour on Current State. Stay close. May be aware that Netflix has announced a 4-episode reboot of the TV show The Gilmore Girls. And basically what's happening here, today is the anniversary, the 16th anniversary of the original show's pilot. And what's happening all across the country, including in Lansing, from what I understand, down at Strange Matter, they've recreated Luke's. So Strange Matter is basically some kind of facsimile of Luke's to commemorate this Gilmore Girls reboot, and apparently enough people heard about it. I mean, if you were driving down Michigan Avenue past Strange Matter today, the line went down the street and out the door and around the block and everything, and you may be wondering what's going on. That is what's going on. It's Current State here on WKAR. Small businesses are crucial to the American economy. So why not equip our youth with the skills and knowledge to start their own? The Young Entrepreneurs Academy does just that by teaching and mentoring middle and high school students all over the country. The local chapter of YEA is in downtown Lansing at the Michigan Chamber of Commerce. Joining us for Neighbors in Action today is the local program manager for YEA, Anita Lindsay. Hi, Anita.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Also with us, volunteer mentor Liz Breed. Hi, Liz.
Hi, thank you.
We're also joined by a student who just went through the YEA program last year, Trip Gallagher. Trip, welcome.
Hi, thanks.
Anita, give us an overview of how YEA works. How long is the program? What do the students get out of this?
Sure. So it's a 30-week after-school program. It occurs on Wednesdays from 4 to 7, and it essentially takes the students through the process of learning how to start and run their own real business, from pitching the idea to local investors, but first brainstorming the idea. We bring in local entrepreneurs. We have instructors that teach them how to write their own business plan, and they'll really open real businesses at the end of this program.
Are the instructors the mentors?
No, we have...
Like Liz or not?
Nope, we have different instructors, trained instructors that come in. We have three different instructors throughout the year, but we also bring in guest speakers, mentors, and go on field trips.
Well, Liz, you're a mentor in the program. Describe what this experience has been like for you. What do you bring to this?
It's a great experience. What's really nice is to be able to help the students kind of evaluate their idea. So I think that's what the mentor's role is. They receive instruction in class, but the mentor can kind of help them think through the process and ask them questions to kind of get them moving in the right direction.
And what's your skill set in particular? What qualifies you to be a mentor?
Well, I have kind of a unique skill set. I'm a librarian.
Everybody feels that way, right?
I'm not an entrepreneur, so I think is what maybe makes me unique. I'm a librarian, and I used to help small businesses in this area. I now work in Jackson, but that's sort of been a passion of mine for a long time. So I have the ability to help the students evaluate the information that they're bringing in and
I see.
Provide them guidance in that way.
And this is not pretending to start a business. Do I have that right? This is
correct.
Actually launching a business.
So they open a DBA, and we connect them with local credit unions.
DBA,
doing business as, or they can select to apply for an LLC.
Okay. Tripp, when did you first get interested in possibly starting your own business?
Well, this program really got me interested in it. They came to my school in the fall of last year, and I applied, got in. So
that was where?
Went from there.
Where were you attending
Lansing
school?
Catholic High School.
Okay, very good. And what was your product or business idea?
My product was the Queen Case, which was a phone case made out of the material coming from recycling plastic water bottles, and the profits were donated to the Flint water crisis.
What was the hardest part about making that idea a reality?
Definitely production, because it's hard to get something like that manufactured, and I ended up starting by 3D printing them.
No kidding. A 3D printing manufacturing process.
Mm-hmm.
How about that? And where did that take place?
In my basement. I used the funds that I won from the Young Entrepreneurs Academy business competition to purchase a 3D printer and start manufacturing.
How about that? Really interesting. What kind of shape is the business in today?
Not really anymore, because the Flint water crisis is kind of winding down or is finished. But back a few months ago, it was doing pretty well. So,
how often do you run into a young entrepreneur like Tripp who earmarks profits toward a greater cause than their own accumulation, their own income?
Right.
That seems to be
a trend. Well, I think that maybe Tripp started that trend. He had that right off the bat and ended up having a few other students from the course.
I hear about this more and more often. I mean, young people
giving back
from the get-go.
Right.
I mean, that's kind of a big motivation was that an essential part of your inspiration?
Yes, that was
inspiration
the main
here?
Focus.
That was the main
product,
focus.
So.
How do you keep track, do you keep track of how many students continue their businesses after graduation, Anita?
We have kept in touch. We've brought the students into different projects and events that we've had, so we certainly intend to keep in touch and track of what the students are doing.
Are you still accepting applications for 2016-17?
We are accepting applications. They can go to our website or give us a call at the chamber, and we can give them an application. You can apply online.
What are your volunteer needs?
We are looking for guest speakers, entrepreneurs, accountants, attorneys, insurance agents, marketing, advertising, any component that is related to business in general.
Understood. How do you get accepted exactly?
So you fill out the application. There's a few essay questions. You come in. We bring in the students for a quick interview to make sure the program's the right fit, and you are accepted if you have the passion, the motivation, the drive to be in the program.
And you accept some pretty young kids here, if I remember correctly.
We do. It is open. Nationally, we accept 11 to 18-year-olds.
Okay, very good. We are talking with three participants in the local Yay chapter. It is the Young Entrepreneurs Academy. Anita Lindsay is the local program manager for Yay. Also with us, volunteer mentor Liz Breed and Trip Gallagher, who went through the Yay program just last year and created plastic cases for cell phones out of recycled or out of 3D printing there. Explain what you bring, Liz, what do you enjoy about volunteer mentoring?
Well, a lot. It's really rewarding to be able to help the students make this idea that they've had in their head into a real, tangible thing, and it's exciting to be part of that process.
But, how long have you been associated with this?
Last year was my first year. And I really liked it a lot. One of the things that was really rewarding for me was to go to the trade show at the end. So all of the students have to have something to exhibit at the trade show. And some of them have services, so they're promoting their service. And it was at Meridian Mall. And so they're interacting with the public, and this is one of the first times that they actually get to showcase to the public what they've been working on.
So how many participants have you directly worked with?
Well, I had one student in particular that I worked with pretty regularly for the six-week period that the mentors work with the students. But then I also helped out with some of the other students as well, so probably four or five total.
Which one will you remember the best, and why?
That's a really tough question because they were all fantastic. The one that I was assigned to work with pretty regularly, Forrest, I probably will remember him probably the most just because we worked most closely together. He started a candle business and used soy wax and lead-free wicks and did really well in the competition. And he was the winner, mm-hmm. the main winner. At the end, and then he also chose to donate a portion of his revenue to pancreatic cancer research. So,
what did he win?
He won a trip to New York.
Right. So the semifinalists, one student from each chapter gets to go to New York, all expenses paid, to then pitch their idea a second time in front of investors to get scholarship money.
They don't meet with Donald Trump, do they?
No. Well, who knows what will happen this year, right?
You're hired. That's what we want to hear, right? Trip, what are some of the things that you will remember from this experience?
Well, some of the instructors I really, really liked, and I am glad to hear that they're coming back this year for this year's students. But I also really learned a lot in this class about just like the business world and especially networking. Like, it really taught me how to get my name out there and like network with adults that never really had done that before. I learned how to write an effective business plan, which is really helpful for the class.
You're attending college?
No, I'm a senior at Lansing Catholic High School.
But are you attending college after you graduate?
Yes.
Okay. What are your plans? Anything business related?
I've been applying to some schools. My number one choice is probably the Naval Academy, but I've also been looking at Wharton at University of Pennsylvania.
Oh, understood. Well, definitely. Business school there. So who do you think should apply for this program, Trip? I mean, what kinds of interests would someone have who would enjoy this experience?
Anyone who wants to learn more about starting a business or small businesses in general or has a drive to start their own business should definitely apply to this program.
Anita, talk to us here in terms of the future of the, now, do you recruit kids from the Lansing? Is your focus the greater Lansing area then for all practical purposes?
Yes, Lansing school districts, private schools, outer has like Grand Ledge, anyone. We really do try to broadcast this program.
Mm-hmm. And how are you funded? This is, if I remember correctly, a Chamber of Commerce Foundation project.
Right. So sponsors, we have business sponsors from around the area, members, non-members, anyone can give to this program. We're looking for sponsors currently to help fund field trips and the investor panel. Last year we gave gave away $5,000 to the student businesses. And so...
Why, Liz, how would you recommend becoming a mentor here for someone hearing this?
Well, I think if people are interested, to contact Anita, and she will kind of step them through the process and assign mentors to students and kind of see what the incoming class is like and then make those assignments.
But who makes a good mentor?
Who makes a good mentor? Well, somebody that can do the time commitment, that's for sure. You need to be able to be there every week for about a 6-week period of time and really work with the students when you're there. But anybody that has, you don't have to necessarily be an entrepreneur if you have a skill set that taps into one of the areas that the students are working on. So like Anita was mentioning, accounting, marketing, advertising, legal things. If you have some type of expertise in that area, I think you would be a good mentor.
And Anita, quickly, the website to learn more?
michamber.com/young-entrepreneurs.
michamber.com is
sure.
really the
yes,
starting
right.
the
that
starting
where...
place there.
Yes.
We want to thank our three guests. Anita Lindsay is the local program manager for YAY, the Young Entrepreneurs Academy. Also with us, volunteer mentor Liz Breed and Trip Gallagher graduated through the program. Thanks to one and all. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Well, a happy spouse means a happier you, according to a recent Michigan State University study. The study surveyed 2,000 couples nationwide and suggests a link between your spouse's happiness and your health. Current State's Brooke Allen sat down with an MSU assistant professor of psychology. His name is Bill Chopik to talk about the findings.
So I'm speaking to Bill Chopik, MSU Assistant Professor of Psychology and the Principal Investigator of the Health and Retirement Study. And Bill, I know we've all heard the phrase, happy wife, happy life, but I think according to your study, it should be happy wife, healthy life?
Yeah, exactly. So in a really large study of nearly 2,000 couples, we found being married to someone who's happy makes you feel better, makes you exercise more, and ultimately might help you lead a longer life.
So the study, it was conducted on a national level?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the Health and Retirement Study is sponsored by the University of Michigan, and they have this nationally representative sample of older adults, and we looked at how the couples changed over time.
And what were the ages of those couples? Were they young or old? Or?
They were older on average, so they were at least 50 years old, and I think the average age was about 68.
And any idea how long they'd been married?
I think on average they've been about 30 years, so they've been married a while.
Definitely a while.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so 30 years older couples. Mm-hmm. What kind of information was the survey looking for?
So we asked everybody a standard happiness measure. So on the whole, do you feel satisfied with your life? And we got that information from both partners. And then we asked them, just how happy do you feel? But then also, do you suffer from a lot of chronic illnesses? Like, have you ever had a stroke or a heart attack or have diabetes or some sort of psychiatric disorder? So we looked at that and then also... physical activity. Do you like going for walks? Do you like lifting weights? All sorts of different indicators.
And then you compared those with the answers, and then you came up with this data.
Yeah, exactly. So we essentially linked how happy someone said they felt to their physical activity and their level of disability and things like that.
So I'm curious, did women say they were happier? Did men say they were happier?
So there's a very... almost non-existent difference. So there wasn't, yeah. So
really?
On average, they were just about as happy. And they're actually correlated within couples. So you tend to be married to someone happy if you're happy yourself, which
really?
Is an interesting thing.
Yeah. Okay, so say that for me again.
Yeah, so it turns out when you look at the happiness of one person and their spouse, those things are related. So the question is, do we sort of grow happier together or do we tend to marry someone who is as happy as we are? And that's a question that we're looking at in our next study.
And when will that be done?
It's going to take a while. You know, it's going to be a little bit.
I'm speaking with Michigan State Professor of Psychology, Bill Chopik, about the health and retirement study that shows if you have a happy spouse, that will actually make you healthy. And okay, so I'm married and I'm having a bad day on a daily basis. I think that we do see in everyday life that our moods affect our spouse.
Mm. Yeah, that's definitely true. Yeah, so there's a lot of research showing that our emotions and even our physical health behavior sort of spread through our social networks. So yeah, when you come home from a long day of work and it's been really crappy, it does make your spouse feel differently too, because you sort of unload all these negative emotions on them. So there's a lot of large epidemiology studies showing that. But we looked at the crossover. So after you have a really bad day and you're not feeling too happy, how does that affect the happiness and health of your spouse?
Okay, so now tell me, there were three potential reasons that having a happier spouse could enhance a person's health. Mm-hmm. So tell me what those reasons were.
Yeah, so the first is that they might just be better at taking care of us when we're sick and things like that. So being married to a happy spouse, they're sort of invested in your health and well-being. So they'll remind you to, say, take your medicine, or they'll drag you out of bed to start the day, or force you.
So a caregiver.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, so they force you to go to the gym. They say, you know, maybe you should order the salad instead of the cheesecake today. And another reason is just having a partner who's happy just makes us less stressed. So imagine you're bogged down by your partner being miserable all the time. That should just, in essence, reduce your stress as well. So.
Were children a factor in this at all, in this study?
There is data on that, but we didn't look at it in this particular study.
Okay, so the children were set aside for this study?
Yeah, yeah. So most of these people, they weren't currently living with their children.
Because they were older.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay, so they were older. Mm-hmm. And as far as health and happiness on a daily basis, what did they say if you saw that they had a major health problem? Was there any significance in that, like if they had a stroke or mm-hmm. a heart attack?
Yeah, so we did control for that. So, and that was related to your happiness. So if you had if you're dealing with a really serious illness, like you're on your deathbed or your partner is on their deathbed, that does affect how happy you are. Obviously, that's pretty standard. But we found over and above that, so we controlled for how concerned you are about your health, your partner's health, like because of these major health scares. And we found that your happiness and your partner's happiness still affected your health.
So no matter how sick you are, even if your partner was still pretty happy, mm-hmm. you could still maintain a level of happiness as well.
Yeah, and we found the effect persisted like over the 6-year duration of the study. So it's not like it reduced or got weaker over time. It still continued to predict how healthy you were.
So the next study you said is going to be on what?
Yeah, so tracking how couples are coordinated over time. So your levels of happiness, your hormones even.
What about looking like each other? Is that in it at all?
There are some studies on that. And we are taking participant photos so we can maybe look at that.
Really?
So maybe people start to resemble one another more and more because they might be exposed to the same stress. And
right.
They develop the same wrinkle lines, you know, that married couples have after being married for 30 years.
So will it be the same age group, or are you going to go a little bit younger, do you think?
This is the whole lifespan. So couples that have been dating for 6 months and those who have been married for 40 years, we're hoping to follow all of them over time. So yeah, we're recruiting from the local community for that.
But tell me what the qualifications would be.
Sure, yeah. So be in a relationship for at least 6 months. Don't be pregnant at the time of the study. You can, you know, recently have had a child. That's totally fine. But yeah, there's not a lot of restrictive criteria. So, you know, if you love your partner, just contact us and we'd be happy to have you.
What's the commitment to that study?
Oh, it's really, really minor. It's you just come in for an hour and you answer some questions. We do take saliva samples to measure people's hormones and how those are coordinated over time too. But that's really simple as well. And it's not invasive and it's pretty low. And then couples can get $50 for just coming in.
So it could be kind of like a date night.
Yeah, definitely. You can learn a little bit about each other, your likes and dislikes.
Get a $50 gift card and go on your way.
There's no drawbacks. Yeah, really. Yeah, go out to dinner right after. Yeah.
Or maybe finds out something you don't want to know about your spouse or somebody you're dating.
Yeah, that's the danger, right? There's always something you might learn.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So out of this entire study, what was the one thing that stood out to you personally?
Well, we were mostly interested in why this was happening. And one of the things we did find is that, you feel happier on average healthier on average if your spouse is happy. But then the physical activity link was really surprising, that being married to a happy spouse makes you more active, like going for walks, doing ironing, doing laundry, but then doing other things like running a marathon or going swimming and like I said, weightlifting before, these really vigorous, intense exercise things.
So hardcore exercises.
Yeah, hardcore and also very light, like, you know, doing laundry and going for walks. If you're married to someone who's happy, you're more likely to do those things, which was kind of amazing. There's all these studies on showing that happy people are healthy people because they, you know, eat fruits and vegetables and then they exercise. But then we thought, like, you know, there's tons of people in our environment that make us miserable,
right,
or happy. And then we're like, well, who's the most important people in a lot of people's lives? And then we thought, well, maybe it's the romantic partner. So yeah, so that was the most surprising thing. We weren't really expecting a huge effect, but then that's what we found.
So surprise.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, thank you so much. And I've been speaking with Bill Chopik, the Michigan State Professor of Psychology and Principal Investigator of the paper Happy You, Healthy Me. Having a happy partner is independently associated with better health in oneself. Thank you so much for being with me today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
For Current State, I'm Brooke Allen.
And that's our show for today. Coming up Thursday on Current State, Ingham County Circuit Judge Bill Collette is a Hazlitt resident who's also a member of the group Stop CATA's BRT. That's Bus Rapid Transit. We'll ask Mr. Collette what he thinks of the agency's new alternative bus rapid transit plans and why he's recommending an audit of CATA and the Tri-County Regional Planning Commission. Congressman Mike Bishop joins us to talk about his 8th District contest against Democrat Susanna Shkreli. Plus, the Flint Symphony Orchestra begins its landmark 100th season this weekend. We'll speak with Maestro Enrique Dimeck about kicking the celebration off with music that appeared on that very first concert program a century ago. That's tomorrow on Current State. We hope you can join us. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Katie Cook directed the show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, Jamie Paisley, Brooke Allen, and to Drew Hill. If you're listening to this on a Current State podcast, we appreciate it. Everything we do here ends up there. Politics, education, what's happening around mid-Michigan and beyond. The Current State Podcast, anywhere, anytime at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get quality podcasts. I'm Mark Bayshore. See you tomorrow. It's Current State.